From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the year 2000, the United States had 18 million manufacturing jobs. Today, that number is estimated at under 12 million. One-third of those jobs gone. In his State of the Union address, President Obama said he wants to bring American manufacturing back on a new high-tech plane with a string of innovation hubs across the country. We're going to look at that push. This hour, On Point, the call for federal investment in manufacturing innovation hubs. You can join the conversation. Is this what we need? Will it make jobs? Where would you plant an innovation hub? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the president in his State of the Union address pushing innovation hubs. He could hardly have made it more high profile. There's a new opportunity, he said, to bring high-tech manufacturing home.
Last year, we created our first Manufacturing Innovation Institute in Youngstown, Ohio. A once-shuttered warehouse is now a state-of-the-art lab where new workers are mastering the 3D printing that has the potential to revolutionize the way we make almost everything. There's no reason this can't happen in other towns. So tonight, I'm announcing the launch of three more of these manufacturing hubs, where businesses will partner with the Department of Defense and Energy to turn regions left behind by globalization into global centers of high-tech jobs. And I ask this Congress to help create a network of 15 of these hubs and guarantee that the next revolution in manufacturing is made right here in America. We can get that done.
The next revolution in manufacturing, said the president, starting in Youngstown. Let's go there. Joining us from Pittsburgh is Ralph Resnick, founding director of that first innovation hub that the president cited in the State of the Union address in Youngstown, Ohio. Ralph Resnick, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
I'm looking at a photograph here, Ralph, of the, I guess, the front end of this. There's a big warehouse behind, very modest here. Looks like, I guess this was an unused warehouse. And it's the big sign that says NAMI on the front. What's NAMI, Ralph?
NAMI is the National Additive Manufacturing Innovation Institute.
Which means what? Additive manufacturing.
Well, additive manufacturing is probably better known as three-dimensional printing. That's what the populace has adopted. But it is a new way of making things where we build components by additively putting down layers of material and actually growing the part rather than subtracting material to come up with our configuration.
I think the popular vision of this is you've got a computer, you sort of program in what you want, the design, what you want to come out. A bunch of stuff gets extruded into a box layer by layer, therefore the 3D printing way of putting this, and open the box and bingo, you've got the part or the piece or whatever it was you programmed in.
Well, that's a pretty simplistic way to put it, but that's pretty accurate.
So here, were you surprised to be cited in the president's speech?
We were. We were hoping that that possibly the National Network for Manufacturing Innovation would be recognized, but we didn't anticipate that that our pilot institute would be recognized. So now, it was quite exciting.
It's interesting. Of course, Youngstown was a very prominent American manufacturing center, steel and more. You're looking out there from Pittsburgh today. The president's thinking about all kinds of robotics and lightweight materials and nanomaterials and photonics. Youngstown gets the push on 3D printing. What does it really mean, Ralph? Describe for us what's going on inside this big old. Is it a furniture plant? What's going on in there? What's the actual enterprise?
Well, the enterprise is centered in what formerly was a furniture warehouse.
Okay.
So within 37 working days after the announcement of the contract, we were able to take this abandoned warehouse and turn it into a state of the art manufacturing lab.
How do you do that in 37 days? What's in there?
Well, I think it really exemplifies the spirit and the enthusiasm of the community. You talk about Youngstown once being a thriving manufacturing area. It is not only Youngstown, but it's really the region that we brought together what's called the Tech Belt, Northeast Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, and we expanded that across Pennsylvania and down into West Virginia, and have chosen Youngstown as that symbolic center of the Tech Belt as our primary focus.
I mean, I'm looking here at a description of what's going on there, and it looks in part as though what you've done is open up this furniture warehouse and bring in a bunch of very sophisticated 3D printing or additive manufacturing machines that are already made, I think. You've got a material extrusion 3D printer in there. You've got selective laser sintering, whatever that is. You've got an equipment for fused deposition modeling. I mean, is that what have you assembled sort of state-of-the-art elements of 3D printing manufacturing there?
Right. What we have put together is not only the physical institute, but also the organization. And that organization includes initially over 130 different companies, universities, community colleges, economic development groups that are all joining together in a collaboration to move additive manufacturing forward. So part of that group is the equipment builders. And those equipment builders have actually consigned equipment to the Institute for us to be able to use and to transition this technology to the rest of the manufacturing community.
So you've assembled a bunch of super high-tier manufacturing equipment. I guess it was already on the market. You've got it there. Now, what do you do with that to begin to weave this innovation that is hoped for?
Well, it's a variety of things. One thing is outreach, working with the community, working with educational system, starting K through 12, getting them familiar with the technology, getting them immersed in the institute to be able to participate in projects. Getting scientists and industry folk to come and validate and demonstrate their products to the point that we can hopefully expedite the transition of additive manufacturing into the mainstream.
What can you do, or what do you do that the private industry would not do? I mean, if this is the new frontier, if it's really promising, why not? We've got a lot of capital in this country right now, a lot of it sitting on the sidelines. This equipment's already out there. Why not let the private sector just go to town with it?
Well, and the private sector is going to town with it. I mean, we see a burgeoning maker movement that has embraced this technology, especially as the cost of some of this equipment has come down. So that's what we look at as the entry-level type of equipment. And industry also is embracing the possibilities that additive manufacturing can enable. However, there are significant issues that we need to overcome that can't be done by one organization itself. Issues such as qualification and certification. How can we be assured that the products that are going to be manufactured by additive manufacturing meet the stringent requirements of the consumer, of the different market sectors such as aerospace, automotive, medical. Those are not issues that can be undertaken by one organization. So we're looking to bring together users, equipment providers, to address those pervasive issues that are impeding the transition of the technology.
If this should work, and we'll look in some detail here, but if this should work, will it bring back Youngstown's jobs that have gone over the years? Or if it's all, you know, super high-tech, fancy manufacturing in a box, do the boxes do it and you don't need that many workers?
Well, that's not really the case. I mean, as I said, I think there's been an oversimplification. I think there's sort of a difference between making and manufacturing. We need to be assured that the products are going to be robust. We need to have a supply chain that's going to assure that we'll have a steady and quality supply of materials.
Is it about American competitiveness, or is it about a volume of American jobs? Because you could be competitive in this 3D printing arena and not necessarily reproduce the number of jobs, the large number, that has gone.
Well, I think, and it has been openly cited that we're not looking to – that we're not going to be capable of bringing back the 15,000 jobs in a steel mill.
Mm-hmm.
But what we can do is to initiate a rebirth of innovation and of advanced manufacturing that could have a significant impact, and that can have a multiplying effect that otherwise we wouldn't see.
That sounds good. We'll look at the details. Ralph Resnick, it's great to have you with us from Pittsburgh today, founding director of the nation's first innovation hub in Youngstown, Ohio, the National Additive Manufacturing Innovation Institute, NAMI. Bruce Springsteen with little Youngstown on his mind. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From the Monongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, to the coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons of metal a day. Now, sir, you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forget my name. In Youngstown, in Youngstown, my sweet Jenny, I'm sinking down here, darling, in Youngstown.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the call for federal investment in manufacturing innovation hubs across the U.S., asking should we do it and where should they go. Ralph Resnick is with us from Pittsburgh today. He's founding director of the nation's first innovation hub, the National Additive Manufacturing Innovation Institute in Youngstown, Ohio. Longtime big manufacturing center hit like many others in the U.S. Federal government now putting some money in there to try and push it out front when it comes to this, what's called 3D printing, sort of new wave, high-tech wave of manufacturing. He's executive director of the National Center for Defense Manufacturing and Machinery. We'll talk about that. Former chairman of the National Center for Manufacturing Sciences, and it's great to have him with us today. You can join us as well. Should we be building a new string of innovation hubs across the country? 15, the president called for in his State of the Union address. Where should they go? And will innovation in 3D printing, nanotech, biomanufacturing, lightweight materials put out of work Americans back to work? Will it put a next generation to work? Will it make this country competitive in manufacturing? In the presidential campaign last year, that was a subject of some contention. Of course, there was a big federal investment in Solyndra. The Republican challenger, Mitt Romney, made a lot of that. On May 31st last year, he made a campaign stop outside of the former California headquarters of the solar panel manufacturer, failed despite more than $500 million loan guarantee from the Obama administration. With news helicopters buzzing behind him, Romney blamed the nation's tepid recovery on President Obama's failure to understand free enterprise.
He thinks that government-dominated decisions like this make America stronger. They make us weaker. They send the wrong message. And the symbol of a serious conflict of interest is something which is extraordinarily troubling to me, and I believe to a lot of people across this country.
Maybe he's right. Maybe he's wrong. A lot of countries around the world putting government money into innovation efforts, and the president saying, let's do it here. Ralph Resnick, please stand by in Pittsburgh. Joining us now as well from Washington is David Hart, director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy at George Mason University. He was assistant director of innovation policy for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy from 2011 to 12, that is in the Obama administration, where he was involved with the creation of the first innovation hub in Youngstown and the proposal for a national network of innovation hubs. David Hart, thank you very much for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Give us a range of the kind of work that these would do. In Youngstown, we've got 3D printing. What else is envisioned, imagined?
Well, you've mentioned a number of the kinds of technologies that might be pursued. Lightweighting of vehicles, photonics, robotics. I think one of the biggest opportunities lies in the area of so-called smart manufacturing, that is the application of information technology both to the design of products and to running factories. Now, let me clarify, I'm not an engineer, so mm-hmm. I need to stay a little away from the technology and leave that to Ralph.
What about the amount of money here? The president's talking about what would this cost if we did it, if we realized the whole program, all 15?
So I want to clarify something important about the money. These centers would be co-invested, and including the pilot center in Youngstown. More than half of the money that's going into that center is from the private sector and from the states, and the states will be important partners here. So the president has proposed $1 billion. That's not an arbitrary number, but an important down payment. And that would be matched or more than matched by private funding. And each of the centers, we imagine, would have about $25 million a year to invest in a range of activities, ranging from research to training to outreach, as Ralph mentioned.
Ralph Resnick in Pittsburgh, how much money is behind your Youngstown effort at this point? How much is committed?
So far, we have had $30 million of government funds committed and close to $40 million of industry and state commitment.
When you, David Hart, hear Mitt Romney, or heard him, I'm sure you were listening last May when he was going hammer and tongs at Solyndra and saying, this is not the way to go. We shouldn't have the federal government's hands in this. It, you know, just ends up in woe. What are you thinking, David? Is it relevant to this?
I think it's a very narrow view of the world that everything is either entirely public or entirely private. There are many kinds of investments where the benefits spill over both to the private sector and to the larger public. And the idea here is to meld private and public investment because both of the sectors are benefiting from it. And this is the pattern that we see in other countries.
So what's the idea behind this? I mean, so far, I don't see Congress stepping up with funding for this. The president's got enough up his sleeve just from the Defense Department and elsewhere that he says he can do, I guess, three on his own. But what is the vision here for what these would, I don't know, ignite if they work? What would happen?
Yeah, so we have two kinds of challenges in the U.S. We have a cyclical economic problem, which I think we're pulling out of, which is related to the financial crisis. But we have a larger long-term challenge that relates to the structure of our economy and the ability to create new industries. We have a wonderful venture capital sector, which takes companies to a certain level. But that scale-up stage, going from a modest-sized company to a real production company, that's a real challenge. And what I envision from these centers is the ability to take new sectors simply from the birth stage into maturity in a way that our country hasn't done very well in the recent past.
What about those who say, well, there you go, that's industrial policy. Nobody does that very well. The thing to do is somehow, you know, give a clear signal to private sector investors, and they'll run faster and farther ultimately.
I think we need to do both. What's important here is that these institutes will be defined by industry, by groups of companies. We're not picking individual companies. So I should say the administration isn't picking individual companies. In fact, many of these centers, and I think Ralph can speak to this, have companies from a wide array of industries where they're facing common challenges. And the goal here is to build a capability that spreads across a number of industries and can lay the foundation for follow-on investment. So what we're doing here is catalyzing private investment and not crowding it out.
Ralph Resnick, is it enough money that's being talked about? Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, was in Singapore a couple of years ago talking with top official there about this $25 million per for these innovation centers. And the Singaporean official was just astounded. He said, 25 million? He said, do you mean billion? Freeman said, no, million. He thought it was, I don't know, a penny ante, peanuts. The Singapore guy.
Well, excuse me. Of course, we would like to see more investment, and we hope as we show value that that investment will occur. But at the same time, we're laying the groundwork here, and we have what we have, and we're going to try and do the best with what we have. I think that we have seen significant enthusiasm amongst the industry, and as David said, we do have a significant cross section and diversity of industry, not only in the sectors but also in the size of the companies. So although we'd like to have more, we're going to do the best with what we have.
David, how much manufacturing do you envision if this worked out? There's a lot of talk about manufacturing coming home. On the other hand, there's been a gigantic move in the last decade abroad, and there's still a lot booming abroad. If everything worked ideally, how much would come back to the U.S.? And in this high-tech era, how much difference would that make in terms of job creation?
Well, I think we have to be careful not to view these innovation institutes as some kind of a magic bullet. An effective manufacturing policy requires a number of components. There's a trade component. There's a tax component. There's a regulatory component. So we have to be working on a number of fronts at once. And the administration has been doing that, although some of those pieces were not heavily featured in the State of the Union address. So I think if we got everything working, we can move forward. And I guess I want to suggest that the biggest payoffs from these are not going to be necessarily in direct production jobs, but in the so-called indirect or spillover jobs. So every manufacturing job that's created creates somewhere between 2 and 5 additional jobs in other sectors. And in fact, we have sort of a backwards way of looking at the economy now. And an MIT report that came out on Friday made this argument very clearly. Manufacturing and services are much less distinct than they used to be. If you are making pipes and the pipes have sensors embedded in them, and you sell a package to the company that's buying the pipe, not just of the pipe itself, but of the service to manage the pipe and think about the flow through it and optimize it and make sure that it can be repaired easily. These are the kinds of sophisticated packages that companies are selling these days. So we shouldn't think of it as going back to an economy that was like the one in the 1950s when the U.S. was by far the dominant industrial country in the world. We're going to be at the leading edge, I think, of a number of complex product service bundles. And there's a lot of manufacturing that's going to go on elsewhere, and it should. We benefit from trade. It shouldn't be the United States' objective to get all the manufacturing jobs in the world. There's plenty to go around. It's to find our niche in this new global economy.
All right, we're listening. I think people's minds are open. On the other hand, you know, we talked a lot about service jobs as employment just went in the tank. Let's bring in our listeners. New Orleans, Louisiana. Michael's calling. Michael, you're on the air.
Well, hello, fellas. Just absolutely adore the conversation. I was wondering to chime in on how much the universities are supporting high-tech manufacturing. I'm in construction, for instance, and the University of Mississippi, and we're in talks with a couple other southern schools that are going to be helping out in terms of the correct education for the jobs that we have available. And this all harkens back to me because I've been in northeastern Ohio, and I've seen the Goodyear offices. And those were all made by Goodyear carpenters who were trained when they were in high school. Where is the tie between university, manufacturing, and government? That's what I would like to see.
We'll pick it up, Michael. Thanks for your call. Ralph Resnick in Pittsburgh, talk with us about Youngstown and the strings that would, as you envision, go down into universities around educating for this effort.
The NNMIs are designed not only to look at technology, but also to look at the workforce and the training, and also to be collaborating closely with our university researchers, looking to transition those technologies that come out of university labs. But that being said, we also have a strong educational component. Additive manufacturing or 3D printing not only can be used as a manufacturing tool, but also can be used as a teaching tool and getting students enthused about manufacturing careers. And that's already being exemplified in programs like Project Lead the Way and FIRST Robotics. In NAMI, we are looking to leverage these programs that are going on. We're working with the community colleges. We're working with the STEM education to see how we can bring that together in a unified way and not only help train that workforce, but also to get people re-enthused about manufacturing.
David Hart, I'm sure people are listening closely thinking, well, where might these go? Youngstown is the first, and there it is. The president says he can do 3 more even without Congress putting up money, or maybe that's 3 in total. Where would the next several go? And when you think about the 15, is there a map somewhere with targets drawn on it, David? Where would these hubs end up?
There's absolutely no map, and in fact, it's important that this program be run in a competitive fashion and we see who steps forward. I would say the bulk of these hubs are likely to be regionally focused, like the one in Youngstown, that is to support the unique capabilities of a place, to involve local and state partners, and to to really create, as the president said, global centers of excellence. So I think we'll see them have those kind of regional focuses. But I don't think we can say where they'll be, and I don't think we should say where they'll be. That's up to the process of competition to decide.
But are you looking for greenfield, or are you looking in general for places where previous job creation economies have deteriorated or collapsed even? Are you looking at Detroit and, you know, Rust Belt sites that could use a new infusion, or greenfield?
So I got to say, first of all, I don't work for the administration anymore, so I'm personally not looking anywhere.
Fair enough. I take it out of present tense, but you were there at the creation. You must have thought exactly about that.
Well, I don't think we have a bias one way or another, honestly. I think we see a number of places reinventing themselves, like Youngstown, like Albany, New York, has become a great center for nanoelectronics manufacturing. And then we have wonderful leading centers of the world, you know, in aerospace and in Silicon Valley. So I personally don't have a bias. I think we need to look where the best proposals come from, where the greatest opportunities come from, and make those investments where the companies step forward and the region step forward and say, we really want to partner up and do this right.
Francesca in East Hampton, New York. You're on the air, Francesca. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree that we need major federal investment in jobs, but I don't think this is the way to do it. We face a jobs crisis, a massive jobs crisis, and a massive climate crisis. So we need massive investment. With the limited resources we have, we need to put that investment in a clean energy and efficiency jobs program that would employ millions of people, unlike these programs, in jobs from low skill to high skill, lifting up poor communities and middle-class communities at good union wages. And the problem I see with this is not only the few jobs that it creates, but also the pollution implications. 3D printing is a kind of technology that employs, is heavily fossil fuel dependent, and the plastic is the feeder stock for it. And I'm quite concerned that we're unleashing a technological revolution that is just going to add to the fossil fuel dependence and pollution of the planet.
Francesca, I will put that directly to our guests, but let me ask you first. You want more broad-based, sort of not necessarily high-tech, just jobs. But if we're not strong on the high end, will our overall economy be strong enough to create that massive jobs you'd like to see, and I would too?
Oh, I'm saying from low end to high end, we've got plenty of room in clean tech and efficiency. I mean, the innovations are unbelievable that are going on, and they really do need a lot more support. I mean, Solyndra is completely a red herring.
Let me take it to Ralph Resnick before we hit the break here, Francesca. Ralph, what about it? Francesca's worried that additive manufacturing, 3D printing is, you know, doubling down on fossil fuels.
Well, number one, plastic is not only the potential feedstock. 3D printing can use a variety of materials. And really, we also do have a focus on sustainability and things like energy reduction, less waste. With 3D printing, you only use the material that you need to make a part. So these are focuses, and DOE, one of our multi-agency partners, is stressing this. In addition to that, 3D printing can enable alternative energy manufacturing. So there are a number of, for instance, in the wind energy that are looking at 3D printing as a new design capability. So we are very cognizant of that and are looking to leverage that clean energy opportunities.
David Hart, in a word, can this lead to mass job creation, mass sustainable job creation, or is that some other program's job?
I think it's part of the picture, but by itself it can't do it. No, it's $1 billion. We have hundreds of billion dollars of challenge.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the call for federal investment in manufacturing innovation hubs across the U.S. The president highlighted the call in his State of the Union address, gave it a lot of attention, especially citing the very first one in Youngstown, Ohio, that is already up and on the rails and in operation. The founding director of that one, Ralph Resnick, is with us today from Pittsburgh. David Hart is with us from Washington. He was in the White House when this policy was being laid out. He's now Assistant Director of Innovation Policy. He's Director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy at George Mason University. I want to reach out to San Francisco right now, and John Kao. He is, among other things, director of the Bay Area Science and Innovation Consortium in the San Francisco area. He's author of Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back. John Kao, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot.
What do you make of the president's push? What should we hear in that push? And is that the way to go to make this happen?
I think it's a very exciting move. We've all been waiting for a strategy from the White House with regard to national innovation, which would be at the level that I think our country requires. And the notion of a network of innovation centers, manufacturing innovation centers, seems very promising. And this is something that I actually argued for in Innovation Nation about 6 years ago when I said, we should have 20 national innovation hubs at $1 billion apiece to kind of create critical mass for an innovation push into the future.
20 at a billion. We're talking 15 at a tiny fraction of a billion each. Does that mean we're not serious, or can you do it on less?
Well, we're very serious, and I'm sympathetic to what David said earlier about, you know, we work with the resources we have. On the other hand, you look at China, which has $500 billion going into their national innovation strategy. Admittedly, it's kind of a conventional approach to leading-edge technologies, or Singapore was cited, where many billions of dollars have gone into creating eminence in life sciences. And sometimes, you know, the old saying goes, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. If you don't have investment, you cannot create critical mass. But I'm also sympathetic to the notion that this is a startup, and the startup is ambitious in several ways, you know, one of which is it relies on cooperation at the federal, state, local, public, private, et cetera, level. And so what emerges and how people step forward with funding is, it, in some respects, unknown.
Talk to us about geography, John. You know, I've seen people looking at your work and saying, well, what does this mean? Maybe we do something on clean energy in Detroit, digital media in New York, healthcare in Nashville, education, I don't know, San Francisco. Where do you see these popping up if they come?
Well, I think there are a number of opportunities that are obvious. You want to, I believe, build on native capabilities, legacy, history, installed base, universities, installed base of expertise. On the other hand, I think a lot of the big moves in innovation going forward into the future are going to emerge. They're not things that can be planned out in advance. So, you know, to me, the hazard of this innovation hub strategy would be if people sat around and said, well, you know, we're going to be prescriptive about what the future looks like because we're really smart. And that, of course, is where a lot of people are allergic to top-down solutions. So I think that some of the hubs will be obvious in terms of their geography. Some of them will be counterintuitive. And, you know, David makes a good point, which is we have to, in a sense, let the market decide. And it's not just the financial market, but also the innovation market.
Do you see this actually happening, or is this just us twiddling our fingers and talking about it? I mean, the talk in Washington this week, of course, is all about sequester and just cutting across the board, not about putting new money into new initiatives. Is it going to happen, A? And B, even if it does, when we're talking millions and China's talking, you know, I, what did you say? 500 what? I mean, many times this.
500 billion.
500 billion. Yeah. It's so many times that we're talking about here. Are we kidding ourselves?
Well, first of all, I think it is happening already. So it's not a pipe dream. It is. It's very real. And I think also it's extremely important. And the other thing to keep in mind is that America has traditionally been at the front end, or the kind of germinative end of innovation, and many other countries have read our playbook and then have figured out how to add value, either because, you know, they have cheap manufacturing. And, you know, in fact, the subtext of all of this manufacturing innovation debate is that there was a fundamental cost advantage to China and other countries that caused manufacturing to flow out of the country.
Cheap
and
labor.
What we're trying to do is create a value-added advantage that brings the manufacturing back.
But will the manufacturing come back with jobs? I mean, we've had, you know, Andrew McAfee and Eric Bjornjolfsson in here from MIT saying, right, we may bring the manufacturing, but it's not going to require a whole lot of human hands. It's not going to bring the jobs.
Well, I think the answer is yes and no. I mean, it's clear that the future of many aspects of manufacturing involves automation, robotics, and a different kind of manufacturing structure. You know, we're not going back to big buildings with smokestacks and people filing in and out in big lines with lunchboxes anytime soon. So the key thing here, I think, is to raise our sights a little from simply looking at manufacturing hubs to looking at innovation hubs. If you look at the whole 3D printing area, for instance, and you let your imagination run wild a bit, there are literally thousands of downstream related businesses, many of which, or if not the majority of which, don't have to do with the technology or the guts of the manufacturing as much as they have to do with what can be done with the manufacturing.
And paint that picture for us, John. Your imagination may be more explicit than ours on this front. Give us a sense.
Well, everything from the fashion industry, the home products industry, many aspects of design can now be accelerated by use of 3D printing. So I imagine there will be thousands of, you know, artisan type entrepreneurs who will use 3D printing to create saleable objects. You know, for sort of a B2C, business to consumer type of activity. Now, so for Youngstown, just as a specific example, if what they're focusing on is simply the technology and the engineering and the academics, I think that's a half solution. I think that, you know, the essence of a hub is to create a garden spot, a Florence, where people want to go, because not only is there venture capital, not only is there enabling technology, but there's culture, there's ambiance. You know, when Singapore designed their Biopolis, which is their life sciences center, they didn't just put in laboratories. They put in an extreme sports center. They put in fabulous restaurants. They put in a concert hall. They wanted it to become a magnet for talent. So in Youngstown, if you set up the conditions where hundreds of young creators want to go and settle down in Youngstown because they can reap the fruits of the 3D manufacturing revolution, then you are going to create lots of jobs. And it may not even be 1 to 5. It may be 1 to 50, depending upon how germinative that particular technology is.
Ralph Resnick, how's your ambiance doing there? Are you building the garden spot, the new Florence in Youngstown?
Well, I think Youngstown already has been going through a revitalization. They saved a theater from the wrecking ball, and it's a magnificent place. The downtown is getting revitalized, but I can say that I recently read Innovation Nation, and that there are many things that are synonymous with what we're doing. And John, we're looking to continue to use that as our roadmap moving forward.
Very complimented. Thank you.
Let's go to Terry in Robbins, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Two prime examples of highly successful innovation centers created by the government is NASA and the Manhattan Project.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both of those have, I mean, especially NASA has touched every life in the United States without exception.
Now, agreed, but we put many, many, many multiples of the kind of money we're talking here into those two, Manhattan Project and NASA. Do you think the scale of investment matters, Terry?
Not necessarily.
But those are examples of big impact projects. There's no doubt about it, and government right in the middle of those. Appreciate your call. Greg in Lexington, Kentucky. Greg, you're on.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi.
My concern is that a lot of these initiatives are kind of built on sand. As long as corporate executives have the opportunity to shop these jobs internationally where the wages are lower, why would they ever make the jobs happen here?
David Hart, what do you say to that? If China is investing in the same kind of efforts on a lower wage base, even as we try and do this, hey, nobody wants to be nihilistic here, but you hear the question that comes in. What's going to bring it back? Even then?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And let me bring another country into our field of comparison, and that's Germany. Germany pays substantially higher wages than here, and has a much tighter environmental policy. And yet they've managed to retain a much larger share of their economy in manufacturing. And I think the difference is very well-trained workers, very strong attention to quality, and very well-focused on particular niches of the market. So I think the answer is we have to do well here in what we're good at, and not try to compete in everything. And there's no question that China is going to remain a huge manufacturing power. They have a huge market, and there's plenty of opportunity for us to sell, I think, into that market as well. But we're going to have to compete on a combination of factors, and certainly not on labor cost alone.
John Cahill, how do you see that working out? I mean, Americans have seen, they've watched eyes wide open for years now and seen the jobs go there, the manufacturing go there. If China and others are also working on this high frontier, what's going to bring it back to the States? I mean, what was it, just last week? We're also reading about, cyber theft, you know, even of American innovation almost as it happens, right out of our computers. How do we win on this plane, John?
Well, we win by being the higher frontier. In other words, I think that if you've been to Beijing anytime recently, you know that the quality of life there isn't particularly good.
We've seen the pictures of the soupy skies, so. Yeah.
You can actually see the sky in the Bay Area. And I think this whole notion of a global war for talent and the fact that there is a resurgence of interest among teenagers and people in their 20s and being entrepreneurs and business creators is one of the biggest assets we have in this country, not to mention the fact that young people from all over the world want to come here because this is the best place to start a company. I mean, America used to have absolute advantages across the board in the innovation game at a national level. And our absolute advantages have all become relative, with one exception, which is that our culture uniquely supports the freedom to fail, to do audacious things, and to take a reasonable level of risk. No other country, even if they have a slick innovation and entrepreneurship policy, really has that in their heart of hearts. And so we are more tolerant of failure if it's constructive in the direction of being successful. So I think what we have to do is really focus on innovation as the core, and the whole sense of connection between academic research and young entrepreneurs and venture capitalists and financiers and also wise stewards of government policy and funding to create a mixture of ingredients that is unique anywhere in the world, which in many respects I think we have and we still have, but it's our seed corn, and we need to be very wise about how we steward it.
John, what about the Mitt Romney critique we heard last year? He didn't win, but he made the critique all through that there's too much sort of government in the Obama formula, and it may stifle exactly the innovation you're talking about. What do you say to that, John?
Well, I think Mr. Romney should get out a little more. I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that every other country in the world that's serious about innovation has no problem with a balance of public and private top-down and bottom-up initiatives. And, you know, if you want a strategy, you have to have a cohesive and integrative vision. You cannot – the invisible hand doesn't necessarily give you the kind of critical mass of a Manhattan Project, which was cited earlier, or nanomolecular manufacturing or smart manufacturing or any of these other things. You cannot rely simply on the bubbling up of ideas and the coincidental collision of those ideas with a few million bucks here or an entrepreneur there and expect that you're going to advance big waveforms of transformational technology. And I think the genius of this particular plan is that it is focused not just on making a certain kind of widget, but really on investing in a particular wave of innovation that is a 10, 20, 30-year wave of innovation that should be generative of many economic opportunities and many jobs.
John, what is nanomolecular manufacturing? Sounds like you're just going to program molecules to...
Well, I mean, it's not dissimilar from what we're talking about in terms of 3D printing. It's looking at the fundamental nature of matter as a key into making things within a digital device like a 3D printer.
Ralph Resnick, describe something cool for us that's already being programmed to be made in your additive manufacturing plant in Youngstown.
Well, we're working on a number of areas, and primarily, we're not looking at manufacturing a product. That is within the private sector to be focusing on, but how we can enable them to do that. So we're looking at getting materials to the point where they can be understood, that they can be put into a database for designers to design to, and be injected and demonstrated at the hub. So we're really working on the enabling aspects of what's going on. And recently, we just completed our first round of reviewing of projects and proposals from our consortia. And we'll be soon, the first week in March, announcing those projects as we go forward.
David Hart, what do you think of the odds? We'll see 15 of these subs around the country, I don't know, in this decade.
I think 50-50. We need some support from Congress. We need governors to speak up. And I think this is something that there should be bipartisan agreement on. And I think if we can get the atmospherics over, you know, that are laying over all of Washington right now toned down a little bit, we'll find a way forward in this area as we've found in immigration and perhaps on gun control.
John, what's the next one or two you'd like to see built? Where? Doing what?
Well, I think that there's a whole cluster around next generation avionics and light materials and related matters. And there's centers of excellence in Omaha and in the Southwest that might, you know, vie for a grant or a set of catalytic events to make that happen. And I think the smart manufacturing piece, which is big data, is up for grabs because there are probably a dozen places in the United States that are really good. And in fact, smart manufacturing is about networked manufacturing. So you could argue that maybe that's one where you have multiple centers because from day one, you want to see them connected and networked and involved in sharing data. So I think the design of these centers is actually a delicious kind of creative opportunity.
We're trying to look forward through the fog and imagine how we might get it done. John Kao is author of Innovation Nation, joined us from San Francisco. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
David Hart at George Mason University, thank you so much for coming on, David.
Been a pleasure.
And Ralph Resnick, founding director of The First in Youngstown, Ohio. Good luck to you, Ralph. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.